For decades, cholesterol has been demonized by our medical system as the root cause of heart disease and something to be avoided at all costs. We avoid eating red meat, thinking that saturated fat will clog our arteries. We follow plant-based diets, and we replace butter and tallow with plant-based seed oils like canola oil, sunflower oil, or soybean oil, all in the name of lowering our cholesterol. But what if we've been fed a flawed story? My guest today is Dr. Anthony Jay, who earned his PhD in biochemistry from Boston University School of Medicine by focusing on this exact topic. In this episode, we focused on two main topics. We dive into the many important roles that cholesterol plays in the body and why it's not the root cause of atherosclerosis or heart disease, and what is the actual root cause of heart disease. Dr. Jay explains why there's no such thing as so-called good cholesterol or bad cholesterol, and how even calling LDL or HDL cholesterol doesn't really make sense. And we also talked a great deal about some of the major issues with how science is currently done in the United States, how easy it is to lie or mislead people with data, and how pharmaceutical companies often shape the way medicine is done and shape our standards of care and our guidelines, and not the other way around, which is why so many of our health guidelines and nutrition guidelines are confusing and often go against common sense. A lot of that is by design, and we did our best with the limited time we had to untangle some of the most common myths about cholesterol and eating meat, blue zones and plant-based diets, and things like that. Dr. Jay also taught me something that I didn't know about the COVID vaccine, which was very interesting as well. And I really appreciated it because I think it's important that we all know how science actually works when some of these big for-profit companies get involved. I hope you find this conversation informative and helpful. I am Stephen Dimmitt, and welcome to Something Different. Dr. Anthony Jay, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I want to begin with your background. I don't always do this, but I think in this case, we're going to be doing a deep dive on cholesterol. We'll see if we have time for other topics as well. But I think it makes sense to start with your educational background and share your credentials to frame the conversation. So you got your PhD in biochemistry from Boston University Medical School, is that right?
Yep, from the med school, which is a different campus than the other campus, but yeah.
Okay. What led up to that? What was your undergrad in? What led you to develop a focus in, or an interest in biochemistry?
I did a biology major and a chemistry minor, but I was a double major and a double minor. But I ended up going straight out of college up to Boston to do Alzheimer's research. And I did 3 years of just full-time Alzheimer's, like brain research. And it was really interesting. And it was actually through the Boston University Medical School. And then I shifted over to heart disease and did a PhD in heart disease. So cholesterol, all that stuff. It was just more fun than going to med school and prescribing drugs to everybody. And actually throughout that process, I kind of became disenfranchised with the medical system in general. Just this idea that we wait until people get sick and then we throw a bunch of drugs at them. And we never really address the root cause of the problem. In most situations, at least. You know, I used to be on board with that whole thing and like statins and all that. Of course, you get pushed and pushed to promote statins and you get taught that cholesterol is evil and it kind of just gets ingrained into your system. So most doctors think that. And they also think the COVID vaccine is amazing, right? They don't read the studies. That's the problem. These doctors aren't trained to read the scientific studies, so they don't really know what's going on. But it's kind of like a cultural accepted, it's like an acceptance. You just, oh yeah, cholesterol is bad, LDL is bad. Well, LDL is super important for your health. It's necessary for your body. And a lot of these animal studies are nonsensical because like mice, they have totally different cholesterol transport mechanisms and stuff. Like they don't have CETP. That's one of the genes that humans have. Mice don't even have that. There's a lot of variation. And then we base a lot of our scientific study on these animal studies like mice and rabbits. You know, it's funny, my research lab, they used to study rabbits for plaque in the arteries. Like, we used to do MRIs of rabbits and stuff, and we would feed them like a high fat diet, like cholesterol. We feed them a cholesterol rich diet. And of course, if we get plaque in their arteries, rabbits are supposed to be vegan. Like, rabbits are not supposed to eat cholesterol. When in nature is a rabbit eating cholesterol, right? It doesn't make sense. But if you give a raccoon a bunch of cholesterol, like, their bodies handle it just fine, you know, but nobody's studying raccoons, including me. But I'm just assuming, like, if you did that, you probably wouldn't have any plaque in their arteries, just like you don't give humans plaque in their arteries if you give them a bunch of cholesterol.
Right.
It's the same thing. But man, do they say that? They tell people that. So it's very tricky and complicated because of the culture, because of the drug companies, and the influence has gotten worse and worse over the years.
Yeah, yeah. You dropped a bomb about the COVID vaccine. We'll see if we have time to double click on that later in the conversation. I think I'm on the same page as you. I'm someone who really didn't feel comfortable with just drinking the Kool-Aid. I ended up getting a single dose J&J, never got a booster. And I've seen so many anecdotes and so much research come out now that I feel totally vindicated in that decision. But I'm sure many in my audience will balk at that. A lot of people in my audience freak out when you mention that.
Yeah. Well, let me just jump in and say one thing about it, right?
Sure.
And I think this is the most important thing. Well, first of all, I think forcing anybody to get vaccines is insane. And that's why I quit Mayo Clinic. I used to work at Mayo Clinic. So after I got my PhD, I went and worked in Minnesota at Mayo Clinic for 3 years. And then I quit because they started forcing the COVID vaccine. And that was tough to do. I've got 5 kids. It's not like a super easy decision, but I just thought it was unethical. They were doing this thing where they would have religious exemptions, but it was kind of nonsense. It was bullshit. They were pretending like they were giving people religious exemptions, and then atheists were applying for this and stuff. And I was like, this is completely ridiculous. And then they were firing people anyways because they didn't accept their religious exemptions. But the most important thing with the vaccines, just as a whole, and people should know this, and I think everybody should be aware of this, is, you know, if I develop a drug, like, say I invent a statin, which lowers cholesterol, right? You can patent that drug and you kind of corner the market, which is fine. And then let's say, and here's something most people don't know. First of all, when I do those scientific studies to prove that a patent, that like my statin is good or my drug is good, I don't have to release that data publicly. Did you know that? The drug companies don't have to release any of the data.
I did know that, but I think most people don't. Yeah.
Yeah. It's shocking, right? Like, you don't even have to release the data. Now, in other words, you can cherry pick whatever data you want and hide whatever data you want for a drug company study and get those drugs approved. The problem is, number one, they'll probably get pulled off the market. And that happens a massive amount of the time, right? It's like 70% of the drugs get pulled. So they get approved and then they get pulled. But it's even crazier because, like, if I have a bunch of side effects from a drug, I can hire lawyers and sue the company and then subpoena the data. So ultimately, you can get that data. You can force that out of the company. Now, sometimes they do paper shredding and stuff. Like, they literally have been known to shred documents. Like, they got busted a couple times, a couple different drug companies for shredding documents and hiding data. But let's just assume that everybody's ethical, which is a bad assumption. But let's pretend that's a real life situation. They're not shredding data. And you can sue the companies and pull that data, right? And we have pretty sophisticated ways to do that with digging up people's servers and all this. But here's where it gets crazy. And here's what I want people to know about with vaccines. Vaccines, if you have an injury from a vaccine, you can't sue the company. It's called the VICP. You have to sue the federal government. It's called a vaccine court. Most people call it a vaccine court. If you look it up on ChatGPT, it's called a vaccine court. But they'll say, well, the vaccine court's kind of the common name. Technically, it's called the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, VICP. But the point is, you're not even suing the drug companies when you have a problem with vaccines. You have to sue the federal government and take tax money to get, you know, some money back from your injury, if that even happens. But so if you sue for vaccines, it's not the company, it's the feds. So you never subpoena the data. You can't. There's no mechanism for subpoena getting the data from these drug companies on vaccines. So in other words, they can hide whatever they want. They can literally just make stuff up and say, oh, the vaccine is 99% effective. And they just put that out there. And I'm a scientist and I'm saying, where's the data? like, where are the studies? And they're saying, oh, there is no study. It's just a press release. Remember that when they said it was 96 point whatever?
Yeah, I remember watching that goalpost move so many times, man. It was 99. It was a miracle vaccine. Then it was 95, yep. Then 90, then 80, then 70. Then like, oh, sorry, you got to get one of these every 3 months. Like I watched that happen and I'm amazed that so few people took issue with that. You know, they're just like, oh, I guess we just didn't know what we didn't know. And it's like,
yeah,
really?
Yeah, like new studies are coming out. And it's like, it was never a new study. It was always just press releases and just nonsense coming out of the pharma companies. They're just pulling out numbers. They're just making stuff up. So even the 70%, even the 50%, whatever, you can't trust any of that stuff, to be totally honest. And that's not the drug company's fault, because of course they're going to do that, because of course that's the way the system is set up. So they're just going to kind of do whatever they want. So we have to change that, right? So that's a sketchy problem to have. And unfortunately, with the COVID vaccine, you can't even sue the federal VICP program if you have an injury from the vaccines, because they were under the Emergency Use Authorization Act, and it was an emergency to push it on everybody. They have a separate program. I call it the CCP, but it's technically called the CICP. It's the compensation injury, whatever. It's some kind of a special designation for emergency vaccines. So basically, they don't pay out. Like if you have crazy injuries from the COVID vaccine, they don't give you anything for it. Wow. Nobody cares, right? So the COVID was a particularly, you know, complicated mess. And most people are kind of aware there was a lot of corruption going on with the whole thing, but they don't realize. You know, as an insider, I realize you can't even sue the company. It's a real problem.
I mean, most people don't even know that all vaccine companies in America are completely immune from liability and have been since the late 1980s. Like most people just don't know that. It's like, yeah, that's exactly. A thing. Like, you know, I'm an engineer, a former engineer. I think of everything in terms of I'm just a realist. I think about incentives and how incentives drive our world. And I learned that one thing several years ago and was like, it just completely shifted the way I thought about everything. I was like, oh,
should.
Because you hear, you know, like I was always someone who got the flu shot, just didn't really think much about vaccines. And this conversation blew up online and, you know, people are getting canceled over being anti-vaxxers or whatever. And you just build this association in your brain that being an anti-vaxxer is someone that believes that like Bill Gates is microchipping people or something like that, right? And like like so many things, the conversation is just like the conversation that the left is having and that the right is having, because all this is politicized now, like everybody's missing. You know what I mean? Like the left thinks that people are just crazy conspiracy theorists. And then there are some crazy conspiracy theorists, but the real conversation we should be having is about transparency, you know, accountability, and just, and there's a little more nuance. It's not that like vaccines are never helpful. It's that, like any pharmaceutical drug, there's a trade-off. There's, you know, there's risks, there's pros, there's cons. And we just have to like evaluate the balance of those two things. And so when you're mandating a vaccine for healthy people that aren't dying of COVID, and then it turns out that like, oh, they're suppressing data and they knew that, you know, in many cases, or in some cases, it was causing myocarditis in kids. Like now that's an issue. And that's why so many people are frustrated.
Yeah, yeah. And the CDC lost all their credibility when they told us that the flu magically was eradicated in 2020 when the COVID came about.
I know, most people don't know that either. If you look at the we usually have like 35,000 cases of flu per
million.
Year in the United
States. 35 million.
35 yeah, million, 30. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then like, what year was it that it just, 2021, it just goes to zero?
2021, there was zero.
There's zero cases.
It was literally like, yeah, it was zero. And then the next year there was like a few hundred, and then it went back to 37 million cases. I think it's like 35,000 deaths per year.
Oh yeah, you're right. You're right.
Million cases.
Yeah, yeah.
It depends if you're looking at cases or death, but either one went down to zero during COVID. And that was the CDC. That was their own data. It's total corruption. They're just classifying COVID, or they're classifying the flu
as COVID.
So then they could get more government, the hospitals could get more money for saying things are COVID to increase the fear mongering.
Yeah.
Ultimately to push the vaccine. So, and again, I'm an insider, so I see this stuff, right? Like I've seen this with statins too. You know, my dad's a family doctor. He's a medical doctor and he's retired, but he remembers. And I talked to a lot of doctors that remember back in the 1980s when the normal range for cholesterol was 300 and below. So if you got like a 250 on your cholesterol, your total cholesterol on your blood test, the doctors would be like, oh, you're fine. You're doing great. And then they dropped it down to 200 and below as soon as they invented statins. I mean, it was like 250 for a while, and then it went down to 200. But the point is, they basically just pulled out of thin air some numbers, and then they just wanted to reclassify the whole population as having high cholesterol. And then they tell you that meat is bad because meat raises your cholesterol, which, by the way, is true. But that doesn't mean it's high cholesterol. That just means instead of being 240, you're 260. And that was always totally fine until the 1980s when they invented statins.
It's true that meat raises cholesterol, not necessarily that meat is bad. Yeah. We're going to get into that. We've already gone off the rails. I think we already lost some people, which is fine. I've already been canceled. So this is great.
Well, the funny thing is, man, when I used to do YouTube videos on COVID, during COVID, they would delete my videos. Like, YouTube deleted my videos straight up. And I was just going through studies. I was actually like, people can check out my YouTube channel. I just sit there and put studies up on the screen and talk about them. I'm not just talking. Like, right here, we're just talking. But on my videos, I specifically show the studies, and it's important if people want to see the studies. I go on my channel and look them up, because it's more technical, but you can't even do that with COVID. They wouldn't let you. Now they do, but they wouldn't back then.
Has it normalized again? You're allowed to talk about whatever you want to talk about? Okay.
From my experience, I haven't been seeing deleted. I haven't even been shadow banned on my science channel now. So that's really shocking. I think it's because Elon bought Ask X. As soon as Elon bought Twitter, it changed. And that was noticeable for me as kind of an influencer. I noticed it.
Right. Yeah. As soon as one platform isn't playing ball, then everybody has to kind of do the same thing. Yeah. As far as suppressing information goes. Yeah. It's crazy. Like, I watched this happen because of who I follow, right? Like, I've been following a paleo diet and paying attention to this stuff since like 2017. Many people have been doing it a lot longer, obviously. But like, so I was following all the types of people who are clued into this sort of stuff before COVID. And I think like the greatest predictor of the experience and the perception that you had during COVID was whether or not you were paying attention to health beforehand. You know, so I watch people that I trusted that are credible, that have PhDs in virology or whatever it is, get canceled and silenced on social media. I watched that happen. And now I'm getting called a conspiracy theorist for talking about it. And I'm like, you guys are trying to gaslight me. Like, I saw it with my own eyes, and a lot of other people did. Yeah. But it's crazy that it's still controversial. Like, some people still think it's all, I don't know, fake news or something. It's bizarre.
Yeah. Well, they don't have time to get into all the corruption in the background, and they don't understand how the pharma companies work and how the FDA works and all this stuff. But it's becoming more and more apparent. And the other thing, you know what was interesting? Like, during COVID, I didn't have much of an Instagram following because I was busy working. And on Instagram, as soon as I hit 10,000 subscribers, they immediately started shadow banning me. So I think there's like a certain amount of people that you can have, and you can kind of say whatever you want, and they just let it slide. And then there are people are like, well, I say all kinds of crazy stuff about COVID, and they don't shut me down. It's like, yeah, because you don't have enough of an audience. As soon as you hit a certain audience level, bam, it was like immediate for me. It was crazy. Like, very obvious. Yeah. And so this kind of...
And what would happen to your account?
Well, they just wouldn't grow it. They wouldn't show it to any new people at all, period. Mm. And to this day, they still don't on Instagram. Like, I have, I don't know, 30,000 followers, but they're all from like people that search my name specifically and like go and follow me. It's not like organic growth. Like, on YouTube, I get legitimately organic growth. Like, when I put a video out on any topic, I'll get my subscribers watching it, but then I'll go to the analytics and it'll say like, yeah, and we put it out to all these foreign people that have never seen your channel, and a lot of them come and subscribe, which is awesome. That's growth, you know?
Yeah.
Instead of just showing it to my subscribers. But that's literally what Instagram does to this day on my account. Mm. And they started that immediately when it hit 10,000. So that's one other way that they kind of convince people that it's just a conspiracy, is because people are like, well, I said all kinds of crazy shenanigans and they never did anything to me. And it's like, well, yeah. So it does trick people, because almost nobody has 10,000 or more. I mean, that's a minority of people that get up into that status of like starting to be an influencer. And I imagine over 100,000, it's even more, and on and on and on. But that's kind of where that's where it gets a little sneaky, right? They kind of like sneak it in there when your audience gets bigger. And then people complain, like people like me complain. And then the regular person that has 500 followers is like, oh, I don't see that. I think that's nonsense. He's just making this up. And it's like, no, it was very specific. It was very obvious for me at 10,000, and I complained a lot about it, like, to my audience.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get back on track here. So I want to talk mostly about cholesterol. I know we have limited time today. What specifically was the focus of your PhD?
Oxidized LDL, heart disease in general. It's very technical, some of the techniques I was using and all of this, but I did a little bit of everything. I mean, it's just heart disease in general, but oxidized LDL was probably my most specific one word thing that I studied.
Okay. So you literally did a PhD in cholesterol, LDL, and heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So I want to talk about cholesterol for two reasons. The first reason is that cholesterol has been vilified. Everyone thinks it's bad. And, you know, if they know a little bit more, then they know that LDL is the so-called bad cholesterol, HDL is the so-called good cholesterol, and so forth. But it's all of that, just like to begin with, is oversimplified. And what gets missed by that is that cholesterol plays many important roles in our physiology. It's important for our sex hormones. That's something you talk about a lot. Testosterone, which is important for men and women, so on and so forth. So we need cholesterol. And it's just fascinating that some really prominent, smart people, you know, have this take that we should be lowering LDL at all costs, just throwing drugs at it no matter what. So I want to talk about like the good things that cholesterol does in the body, that some of the reasons why it's important. That doesn't necessarily mean that like higher is always better. I want to get your take on that, but I want to dig into that. The second reason I want to focus on it is because I'm kind of pulling the thread on this conversation that I've had so far on this show. Justin Nault and I talked quite a bit about seed oils. He gave his analogy of the hydroelectric dam and why, you know, polyunsaturated fats create these lipid membranes that are less effective for producing ATP in our cells. And then I had Dr. Kate Shanahan on, and we talked about her book, Dark Calories, which I still think is the best treatment on this topic that I've come across. Seed oils, vegetable oils, whether or not they're healthy or not. Her arguments that they're destroying our health, and I agree with her. But we didn't have time in that conversation to get into cholesterol at all. So I want to talk about it with you, because the entire pro seed oil argument essentially hinges on cholesterol, right? Like the mainstream medical establishment and the average Joe Schmo out there listening thinks that elevated cholesterol is bad and causes atherosclerosis and heart disease. And we know that consuming seed oils or vegetable oils, and I'm talking about like, you know, sunflower, safflower, soybean, canola, corn. It's Dr. Kate Shanahan's Hateful Eight, right? There's a couple more. Those things do lower LDL cholesterol. We know that. That's actually true. But they always, you know, the argument, the people arguing that seed oils are healthy always make this leap where seed oils lower LDL, therefore they're healthy. But I wonder if you're aware of, I still haven't seen a single study that actually looks at outcomes in human beings when we replace saturated fats with seed oils and shows a positive benefit from that. Maybe there's some out there, but it just seems like a giant house of cards, but we have to talk about cholesterol to help people understand what's going on there. So anyway, you did your PhD on this exact topic, so I'm really excited to dig into it with you. I want to start with a couple terms, because I actually didn't know this before starting to watch some of your YouTube content. What is LDL? Like, we hear LDL cholesterol, we think it's bad, but what is LDL exactly?
Yeah, it's fat transporter, right? So it's not cholesterol. Everybody calls it cholesterol, but that's literally made up by the drug companies to sell statins that lower cholesterol. So all this talk about good cholesterol and bad cholesterol, almost all of it is just nonsense. LDL is technically a lipoprotein. It's a protein.
Low density lipoprotein?
Yeah, low density, and high density is HDL.
Yep.
And neither of those are good or bad. They're both good because you need them for survival. And it's ridiculous to say it's bad. One's bad and one's good. But LDL basically brings fats around your body, and HDL brings them back to your liver. So LDL is a fat transporter. I always describe it as like a taxi or like a limo service. It just kind of brings them around, because fats float on your blood, right? Your blood is aqueous. It's like water. You can't move fats around your blood because it would just float on water, like olive oil floats in a glass of water. Mm. You have to have a lipoprotein that moves them around your system. And it doesn't just move cholesterol. It moves some cholesterol. I think 8% of LDL is cholesterol. but it's also full of fats and stuff and other types of lipids like phospholipids and whatever. It's full of fats. So this idea that it's called LDL cholesterol, why isn't it called LDL phospholipid? Why isn't it called LDL fatty acid, like fats, right? Like, it doesn't make sense. The only reason is because statins are set up to lower cholesterol, so they want to demonize cholesterol. So the whole nomenclature, the naming of it, is just completely ridiculous. But people should think of it as a fat shuttle, like a fat taxi. LDL is a fat taxi, and HDL brings it back to your liver. And both of those are good things, because if you're burning fat for energy, you got to have high LDL. You got to move it around your body.
Right. It's just like having, I mean, it's similar to having elevated glucose when you eat sugar. If you're burning sugar, like your body has to send that glucose around your muscles and, you know, for you to be able to burn it. So if you're on a low carb diet or a keto diet or carnivore diet or one of these things, it makes sense that you're going to have more taxis shuttling the fat around, because that's what more you're, LDL. That's what you're burning. Yeah.
Exactly. And sugar goes into water. If you take a bunch of sugar and you dump it in water, it constitutes in water just fine. So you don't need a transporter for sugar. In fact, a lot of people's high blood pressure comes because they have too much sugar in their blood and it thickens your blood. Mm. It's kind of like maple syrup blood. And then you have to put more water into your blood, which pressurizes your blood. And then you know what the doctors blame? Salt,
right.
Which is ridiculous. Because salt doesn't stay in your blood. It kind of goes in and then it goes back out. It goes into your cells. So salt almost never causes high blood pressure. It raises your blood pressure for 10 minutes after you eat a whole bunch of salt, but not permanently. Mm. But it's the sugar.
And chronically elevated blood glucose.
Exactly. The glucose, which is a synonym for sugar. So if you get rid of all the sugar, like if you have a real nice low blood sugar, which would be like 75 for an American unit, like, and if you're in the Europe, it would be like below 4.7. If your blood sugar is 4, if you live in Europe or Canada, that's nice and low. That's super good.
That's very low.
Yeah, I keep mine in the 70s. Yeah.
Wow.
I can get mine down to 30, by the way, which is pretty wild. I have a bunch of keto friends that can get their blood sugar down in the 20s and 30s.
I think most doctors would think that you would die, right?
They'd tell you that, yeah.
That's fascinating.
I can go jogging for 10 miles with my blood sugar at 30.
That's right? Crazy. Okay.
And by the way, the only way to do that, have you heard of gluconeogenesis?
Yes. So that's your body's ability to take proteins and convert it into sugar. Yeah.
Sugar. Yeah. Good call, man. Good. Yeah. Most people don't know that. So your body can take protein, turn it into sugar. You can't do that with fats. Did you know that? You can't take a fat and turn it into sugar.
Isn't there a triglyceride? Isn't there like a glycerol backbone that...
Yeah, but that's kind of glycogen, or is off that... the deep end a little bit. Because
okay.
Did you know low-carb diets lower your triglycerides?
Oh, I didn't know that. No.
So then you have a lot less of that glycerol backbone to turn into sugars to be begin. So like this idea that like, yeah, you can convert fats to sugar. I get it. Like there is some nuance to that. But in general, you physically can't take a fat and turn it into sugar. You can turn that little piece of that triglyceride when there's three fats and stuff. Again, that's kind of... But your body doesn't really do that. Generally... You can get your blood sugar crazy low if you cut protein and carbs and you just see tons of fat. And I'm not saying suggesting this for anybody, but I'm just saying like you can, and I've done it, and it's very proof is like the concept is very real, because you can wear a CGM and watch it, and you can prick your finger and watch it with the blood glucometer.
Yeah.
But obviously when that happens, your LDL goes up super high because again, you're transporting fats, you're burning fats like crazy because that's your primary energy source. And your sugar obviously is not even there. And that's totally fine. Your body can survive like that. In fact, your heart prefers fat for energy. If you Google, like, what's the preferred fuel source for your heart? Fat, fatty acids, preferred. Your brain actually prefers sugar if you give it a choice. And scientists have done these studies where you take radioactive sugar, protein, and fat.
What do you mean radioactive?
Put it in the heart. What's that?
What do you mean radioactive?
Like you literally put a little tag on it. Like you can make hydrogen radioactive or whatever. So it's not dangerous, but it's still tritium. It's called tritium. That's a hydrogen H3, right? So it's detectable. And you can put like little signatures. Like you can make oxygen radioactive or carbon radioactive. And you can have a protein that's a little bit radioactive in a certain way and a fat that's radioactive. Because the three macronutrients are proteins, fats, and carbs, right? And you can tag all three of those uniquely. And you're not putting like a big bulky tag. You're just putting a weird radioactivity to them that you can read out, you can measure, and then you can feed it to brain cells, and you can feed it to heart cells, and you can feed it to liver cells. And most cells in your body, if you give your cells a choice, they'll burn sugar. Most of the time, if you're eating sugar and fats, your body's going to burn sugar for energy. It's dirty energy. It's not as clean as fat burning, but your body will do that because it's like, well, you got fast acting cocaine energy. Let's just burn that. That's what your cells do. You know?
Yeah.
But the heart's unique. The heart doesn't do that. The heart burns fats.
Okay.
Preferentially.
Man, you're like a, I'm like a kid in a candy store. There's so many things I want to pull on right now. I can't decide where to go. I keep derailing us, but I want to get your take on carbohydrates in general. Cause it's, I actually don't know this about you. I don't know what your diet looks like or what you advocate for. I know you do genetic testing with people. So maybe it's kind of tailored to the individual. Yep. But I'm curious about this, and I think a lot of people are curious about this, because at the end of the day, talking about cholesterol, talking about all these things is interesting, but we all have to decide what to actually eat, you know? And I tried keto for quite a while, or rather, I did keto successfully for 6 months or so many years ago. I've tried the carnivore diet. I've always not been able to stick to it very long because I just don't feel as good. I'm a rock climber, as you know. I prioritize high intensity, low duration, very glycolytic power, you know, like bouldering. That's what I do a lot. Mm-hmm. And I feel I've been on some version of like a, you know, ancestral animal-based paleo diet for many years now, and I have consistently found that I just feel better and seem to operate better and even stay a little bit leaner if I eat 150 to 250 grams of carbs per day versus lower than that. I'm super active. What is your take on carbohydrates? Like, is it always dirty energy? Is it always worse than burning fat, so to speak? I mean, because Justin Nault talked about this too. Like, there's a case to be made for revving up your metabolism and thyroid health and all these things by including carbohydrates, kind of telling our body like we're abundant, we're in like summer mode. I don't know.
I don't know. It's a good call. Well, yeah. I mean, it's dirty, but your body can flush out all the dirt, all the diesel fumes and stuff if you're training and you're active and stuff. If you're sitting at a desk all day, and I change my diet based on how active I am day to day sometimes. Like if I do a lot of phone calls at 8 p.m. at night because I talk to people from Australia doing DNA consults all the time, and it's like 10 a.m. over there. And I'll just like go low carb at dinner too sometimes if I'm sitting down all day. I don't like to tell people my diet because I don't want people to be like, oh, that's what he's doing, so I'm going to do it like that. Because I do look at genetics and I try and customize people's diet in really specific ways. But I do fast. I do a lot of intermittent fasting. I never eat breakfast, for example. But again, a lot of women, especially post-menopause and stuff, it's different and their hormones change a lot more. It's very complicated. But I usually eat zero carbs for lunch and I eat carbs for dinner.
You do eat carbs for dinner.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like you sleep better.
Carbs, you sleep better. Right.
Yeah. If you go keto for too long, you start to lose your sleep, and that's just not sustainable and good for both.
That's what I experienced. It's crazy that you have these two different takes that are polar opposite from really smart people. Like some people say you're more insulin sensitive in the morning and you want to eat more carbs earlier in the day because you're active, you're moving around, you're going to burn that stuff. And then you want to be lower carb later in the day so that you can fast overnight or like burn fat overnight and all those sorts of things.
Sure. Well, it depends on your activity. I mean, if you're training super hard in the morning, I could see an argument for loading up on carbs in the morning. I don't. I sit at a desk and talk on the phone in the morning.
Yeah.
I haven't eaten anything all day. It's 2:30 my time. But that's just today, you know, like I'm really busy. I've literally been on the phone all day since 8 a.m. this morning. And so I'll just do one meal today. No big deal. I'm not physically active. But yeah, if I had gotten up and done a bunch of deadlifting in the morning, I can see an argument for having some carbs. I probably wouldn't have a lot of them. It depends on your goals, right? I'm older. My goal is not to...
How old are you?
Super, 41.
Okay.
But my goal is not to get like super jacked. And like, honestly, I'm happy with my body weight.
You look super fit, by the way. I like talking to doctors who look really fit. I'm like, I'm going to listen to you.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I haven't been to the gym in like over 2 years. You know, I moved to South Dakota like 2 years ago. I haven't been to a gym, but I do a lot of real life stuff. I love rock climbing. Rock climbing is technically a gym. So I go rock climbing, right? We have a family membership.
I love that you're a climber. Yeah, it's great.
But that's training. I do training, but I haven't lifted weights, and I used to, and I want to, but I haven't gotten around to it. But a lot of this is diet, right?
Yeah.
And my point is, a lot of the diet is is dependent on what your training is like. But for most people, they're not training super hard, just in general, but especially they're not training right away in the morning. Again, it's variable, right? So that's the problem. And it's genetic, meaning if you have like a ton of diabetes risk genes, and a lot of people do, they can't handle carbs nearly as well as people that have like amazing abilities to just flush sugar out of their systems. Mm. And they can go on the sugar diet and they feel totally great and whatever. And it's like, well, I don't recommend the sugar diet for anybody. That's kind of like the cocaine.
That's a
diet.
Real thing, by the way, for people that don't know about it. The sugar diet is like having a resurgence and like popping off online right now. It's fucking fascinating.
Exactly. But also very genetically driven, meaning like some people do that diet and they feel terrible and it doesn't surprise me. And
that
I
makes
look
sense.
At their genes and I'm like, yeah, of course you feel terrible doing this. It reflects all these diabetes genes you have. Insulin resistance is really bad, man. And this is one of the reasons stress is really bad too, because stress raises cortisol chronically and that causes insulin resistance, right? And then you end up with just a bunch of sugar sitting around in your bloodstream. Mm. And then your body can't even take it up to the cell. So you're not even utilizing it. And obviously if somebody has insulin resistance, well, then they shouldn't be doing a bunch of carbs in the morning for training because they already have a bunch of sugar that's just sitting around in their blood. They have to teach their body to burn fats so they actually have some fuel. And then they can work into, once they get their metabolism healed, they can work back into having carbs. And so even that's changing. And by the way, testosterone protects your metabolism, protects against insulin resistance. Estrogen does too for women. Progesterone does too. So if your hormones are terrible, and a lot of people have terrible hormones, then you have to change your diet based on that. And your age, you know, your metabolism slows down with age. So you have to change your diet based on that. So there's a lot of variables. And then you go to the medical system and they're just telling everybody eat tons of grains and don't eat meat. And it's like complete nonsense. But right. That's what we're up against.
And we will be right back. I eat a lot of protein every day. I think it's the single most helpful daily habit I've ever implemented when it comes to changing my diet. It made my sugar cravings go away, and I just feel better overall. I maintain strength and a good body composition more easily than I did in my early 20s when I was more plant-based. I'm 36 now. I'm a believer in making high-quality protein the foundation of every meal. I want to tell you guys about what I think is the best source of protein you can buy, which is Maui Nui Venison. I recently put out a podcast episode with Jake Muse, the CEO and founder of Maui Nui Venison, where we covered the origin story of the brand. Be sure to check that out if you are interested in environmentalism, food systems, and sustainability, and how to eat for peak performance. It was a fascinating conversation. This is truly one of the highest integrity brands I've ever come across. I love what they're doing. They're turning an invasive species of deer on the island of Maui into an invaluable food resource. They built a team that are like the Navy SEALs of food harvesting. They're providing insanely nutritious meat, and they're giving a lot back to their local community. Check out the episode to hear more. And if you want to try out their meat, head over to MauiNuiVenison.com/Steven to secure your venison today. I love their breakfast sausages. One of my go-to breakfasts is 3 Maui Nui Venison breakfast sausages with over easy eggs cooked in grass-fed butter. I also love their meat sticks. Those have become a staple for me on days when I lift weights or do my rock climbing training. It's a simple way to up your protein, and their fresh cuts of leg medallions and loin chops and their ground venison are all amazing as well. Supply is limited by the nature of their work. So once again, head over to MauiNuiVenison.com/Steven to secure your venison today. Link in the episode description below. Again, that's MauiNuiVenison.com/Steven. Gentlemen, I've got a question for you. How much do you like your underwear? If you're anything like me, you probably walked into JCPenney or Macy's or Walmart and bought a 6-pack of Hanes or whatever they had on the shelf that was in your size. I recently needed to replace a bunch of my old ratty underwear, and I replaced my entire underwear drawer with Nads. And I love them. They're my favorite underwear I've ever owned. I'm a boxer brief guy. I bought like 10 pairs of their boxer briefs in black. I wear them every day. They're super comfortable. They're made with 100% organic cotton, which is great. They provide enough support without being restrictive. I wear them when I climb and work out, as well as for everyday wear. They're perfect. They also have a classic boxer and shorter cut trunks, if that's your thing, and a no-fly version of their boxer briefs, so pick your preferred flavor. Use my special link in the episode description below, or go to nadsunder.com and use code STEVEN to get 15% off your order. Again, use my special link in the episode description below, or go to nadsunder.com and use code STEVEN to get 15% off your order. Give your boys the home they deserve with NADS. And now, back to the show. Let's get back to cholesterol. So the mainstream narrative around LDL specifically is the higher your LDL, the more likely you are to get atherosclerosis and die of heart disease, stroke, heart attack, things like that. What is your take?
That's a little bit true. I'm not even kidding. I just talked to somebody from Washington State like just a few minutes ago, and in other words, your area, and he is a cigarette smoker, and his LDL was off the chain. He was like 35 years old, and his LDL was horrible. And I was like, "Well, bro, you probably just because you're smoking." And he was eating like fairly healthy, but I'm like, "You gotta stop smoking cigarettes." And I showed him. I was sharing my screen, and I just pulled up like a couple studies showing that cigarette smoking raises LDL. Mm. And it's because, by the way, you're causing a whole bunch of inflammation, and your body has to heal from all that inflammation. You're shredding up your arteries with all the cigarette smoke chemicals and all this stuff, and your body has to heal that. So it raises cholesterol. It raises LDL. I don't even want to call it cholesterol because that's false, but that's what doctors do, and it's such a bad habit. But your LDL goes up from smoking to heal yourself from all that damage. And so, yeah, so there are cases where high LDL is indicative of a problem, meaning it's because of smoking, it's because of binge drinking. Binge drinking raises LDL. I think cocaine even raises LDL. There's a whole bunch of things that are really bad, like lack of sleep raises LDL. So it's a good marker for bad health if you're just looking at the general population sometimes. But then red meat raises LDL too, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. And you can't prove that there's anything wrong because there's nothing, the studies don't show that there's anything wrong. But again, like, that's nuanced and that's complicated, and people don't want that kind of complication. But that's right. Just the facts. That's why it's tricky.
Yeah, I love that. So the analogy I've heard a few times is it's kind of like if aliens were looking down at our planet, they might notice that every time there's a fire in a building, there's a lot of firefighters that show up. And then they might, if they're not very smart aliens, which they probably are smarter than this, but if they're not very bright, they might come to the conclusion that the firefighters are causing the fire, because every time there's a fire, there's a lot of these guys in weird suits around. But it's exactly backwards. So that's a similar thing with LDL, where we do find LDL in plaque, in arteries, but the LDL is actually going there to repair the damage that's being done to the endothelium and the walls of our arteries, right? But it's not necessarily the thing that's causing that damage in the first place. Is that correct?
Exactly, 100%.
So what is causing the damage? What is the real culprit here?
It's complicated. Well, it's different for different people. Like, some people have bad genetics for homocysteine. And sure enough, you look at a bunch of homocysteine research and you find homocysteine is extremely damaging to arteries, right? And some people have amazing homocysteine genetics and they don't have any problems with that. But then they have a bunch of hemochromatosis genes. Do you know what hemochromatosis is?
No.
That's when you have too much iron in your blood. It's technically ferritin, but it's too much iron. And you've heard of antioxidants. Iron is an oxidant, right? It's the opposite of an antioxidant. It's basically oxidative. It's causing inflammation if you have too much. I'm not saying iron is bad because you need some iron, but if you have too much, now you're damaging your arteries from freaking iron, and then LDL goes up to repair that, right? So there's all kinds of, I could list off probably 100 of those if I sat down and like really thought through people's genetics and different types of inflammation. I mean, there's always the question, like, maybe some of these preservatives are inflammatory too, that people eat when they're eating Doritos and Cheez-Its and all this junk food. There's all kinds of weird chemicals and preservatives and that stuff. And 99% of the time, we haven't even done studies on those preservatives to see if it's triggering damage to arteries, of course. So there's probably a lot of other things that we don't, like a lot of unknowns, but ultimately those are triggering your LDL to come and repair the damage too. But we have a lot of knowns that are for sure damaging arteries. And that's what you see in real life. I mean, even viruses, when you have a high viral load, like if you have a virus infection or a bacterial infection, LDL goes up, right? Because you start damaging your body, you have to fix it. And LDL is like a quick repair mechanism. And then your body slowly repairs on top of that or with, and you know, like if you don't have inflammation, you can have outrageous LDL. Like I know people that are literally 500 on their total cholesterol and they have zero plaque and they've been 500 for decades. So that's a good proof that LDL doesn't cause heart disease, because if LDL caused heart disease, everybody who is 500 on their cholesterol would have crazy heart disease almost immediately.
Right? Mm, yeah.
And by the way, if somebody has diabetes, like that quadruples your risk of heart disease, right? Because that's that insulin resistance, you know, that can damage arteries too. Just having high hemoglobin A1C, that's a very sticky protein, right? It's full of sugar. Like you've heard of hemoglobin A1C.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's literally hemoglobin. It's blood cells. It's how much sugar is stuck to your blood cells. How sticky are your blood cells? That doesn't sound good for your artery lining, you know, like the walls in your artery, especially if you're if your heart wants to burn fat for energy, but it's all gunked up with all this hemoglobin A1C, I mean, you're definitely contributing to clotting. You're definitely causing damage to the walls, the lining of your cells in your coronary arteries. And you're having problems feeding your heart, right?
Yeah.
So it's complicated, in other words.
It's complicated. Yeah. So that gets us into a really interesting question that I've thought about a lot. So I'm convinced that saturated fat, eating meat are not the root issue of a lot of our health problems. I think the opposite. I think meat is a really healthy food for humans. However, saturated fat is associated with higher LDL. Our LDL tends to go up when we eat more saturated fat. And so the deeper question here is, because we live in this very often compromised, strange society ecosystem that we're stuck in, right? Like, a lot of the forms of oxidation that you mentioned, or even the genetic things that you mentioned, like might be unavoidable for folks to some degree, right? Like like you can avoid smoking, you can avoid binge drinking, you can avoid these preservatives in food, but it might be a lot harder to avoid a stressful situation for your job, or bad sleep because you have weird hours, or a young child that cries at night, or you know, those sorts of things. Or you might just have genetics that that make it, you know, not optimal for you to have elevated LDL. So there's a little bit of nuance here. Like I can understand why people have jumped to the conclusion that, well, it's probably best to just not eat meat.
Give everybody statins.
And give everyone statins because, like,
I've heard this.
The fire's there, right?
I've heard this before. Yeah.
So like, why add a bunch of meat and saturated fat on top of this? And I think that's the wrong way of thinking about it. I think it's better to like try to address all the other stuff and keep eating a healthy, ancestrally aligned diet. But
exactly.
I get the argument, you know, like thinking about myself, like, I didn't have a good diet for most of my life until my late 20s. And so, you know, if I pile a bunch of saturated fat and like have elevated LDL now, given that like my background wasn't super healthy, is that an issue, or am I going to recover from that? You know, and, or like, I'm kind of stressed more than most people. And like, that's something I need to work on. So in that context, is like eating meat potentially harmful? Anyway, I would love to get your thoughts on some of that complexity.
Yeah. Well, first of all, stress, like the problem is, let's say you're stressed, right? Because I agree with you. You can mostly eliminate most of these things that damage your arteries. Like you don't have to smoke. You don't have to binge drink. Like you don't have to eat preservatives and nonstop like Doritos. So most of the stuff is very easy to eliminate once you recognize how bad it is for your body. But the stuff that's hard is like the stress, like you're saying, and the lack of sleep, because you're trying to make a living, and you know, our society is set up around, you know, just dehumanizing people and working for these giant corporations and getting fired easily and all this nonsense. So it's hard. But the problem is, let's say, oh yeah, that led to high cholesterol. Like that lack of stress can lead to high LDL. Should you just take statins for that? Well, the problem is, if you just take statins for that, then you feel more tired. You usually have muscle dysfunction, you know, like you train less, you exercise less, or that stress just leads to brain dysfunction or thyroid dysfunction or arthritis in your joints. It ultimately always crops up with something else, meaning you can't just take a drug and eliminate the root cause of a problem. It's always going to crop up as some other health problem once you suppress one of the health problems. You know, like in other words, it's not sustainable. You have to fix the root causes and you have to identify them properly.
Yeah.
In order to ultimately dial in your health. That's what I do, what I do, right? That's why I look at genetics, because it makes it so much easier than just guessing. But I mean, I can see the argument. The other problem is, like, our ancestors probably truly did not eat Wagyu beef, right? They didn't eat like super, super fatty meats. And so there is a point where, like, yeah, some people genetically don't do well with lots of saturated fat. They shouldn't be freebasing coconut oil and MCT oil and whatever. They shouldn't be like doing tons of saturated fat.
Sticks of butter every day.
Yeah, like that can become a problem, especially if your ancestors didn't do it. And again, you can see a lot of that in genetics. But and the other problem, Stephen, you probably don't know this, and a lot of your audience almost certainly doesn't know this. A lot of the studies done on saturated fat, they take soybean oil and then they hydrogenate it to make saturated fat. They don't do studies on animal fats most of the time. Most of the time, they just take a bunch of soybean oil and make a fake version of saturated fat. And then they show you how bad it is and how much it raises your cholesterol. And it's like, well, if you just eat animal products, it doesn't raise your cholesterol that much, but it gets exaggerated because of all these nonsensical studies that they do with soybean, like hydrogenated soybean oil, which is full of residual chemicals and nonsense, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's something that I think I just like want to scream this from the rooftops. Like, so there are so many limitations with nutrition research, and so much of it has been adulterated. I mean, like the entire diet heart hypothesis, Ansel Keys, like that entire thing is problematic. Like if people do a deep dive on Ansel Keys and they learn about the 6-country study, which was actually 22 countries, and he cherry picked six of them to make it look like if you eat more fat, you have more heart disease. Yep. And then I just learned recently about the Minnesota coronary experiment.
Sure.
Do you want to talk about that? A little bit.
Ansel Keys is from there. Well, did you see my Blue Zones video too?
I did, yeah. Let's talk about that. I wanted to ask you about that too. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, all of it. Like, it's hard with these studies because sometimes there's intentional corruption. It's unbelievable. Like the Blue Zones, was it 9? I think he definitely had like 9 power principles. I think there was like 9 Blue Zones also.
Do you want to frame what the Blue Zones are?
Yeah, so it's supposedly regions of our world where people live longer. Right.
Yeah.
But the irony is he cherry picked them. Like the longest living region is Hong Kong, and they eat the most meat per capita. You can Google it, like Google Hong Kong red meat consumption. It's the highest red meat consumption per capita in the whole world. And they have much longer lifespans than like most of the Blue Zones.
And the Blue Zones, you hear about them in like vegan documentaries on Netflix. Like they always get referenced to prop up the vegan diet.
Exactly. Yeah. Because they say that those Blue Zones have, you know, like less red meat consumption and all this other. Yeah, that's exactly right. Like almost all of the Blue Zone stuff is just marketing for vegan diets. That's how people have utilized it. It's not really written that way in the book, but that's how it's come out. Like the book was a long time ago, but, and he's written like multiple, his name is Dan Buettner and he's the author, but he's written multiple follow-up books that just keep saying the same thing in different ways. And he just keeps doubling down on this idea, but it's just the same as the Ansel Keys stuff and all this nonsense. It's just cherry picking, unfortunately. And, you know, like it's complicated. People should watch my video on it too, because I go into all that detail, but
yeah, I'll link to it.
It happens all the time in science. That's my problem with epidemiology. I almost am tempted to just say we should just throw epidemiology out completely because it's such nonsensical stuff. Like this idea, like you can take a population of people and then just ask them questions. Like what they do is they call people on the phone and they say, hey, do you eat meat? And if the answer is yes, or if the answer is no, they just check a box and they call thousands of people and they say, oh, look, people that eat meat are less healthy, right? We looked at their medical charts. And it's like, yeah, but they're also smoking cigarettes.
Right.
And they do this all the time. And it's like, it's nonstop with like the eggs are good and eggs are bad and eggs are good. And next week eggs are bad for you again. And it's just because of epidemiology, and it's nothing but confusing. The only good thing about epidemiology is they do tracking of diseases. They do disease surveillance. So sometimes like and they mess with that too, right? Like for COVID, they blow up the numbers and they pretend like it's super scary when it's just completely marketing for vaccines. But at least we should have disease surveillance. Like we got to track diseases, you know? And that's technically epidemiology. So there's a little tiny sliver of goodness from epidemiology, unless that gets corrupted. But the general idea that we can do these population studies on like whether coffee is good or bad based on questionnaires, just questionnaire studies in general are complete trash every single time. I mean, yeah. You can't find a good, people are just using them to try and confirm some kind of confirmation bias. They're lumping huge groups of people together that are genetically diverse. And then they're making conclusions that multivitamins are good or multivitamins are bad. And it just never ends with the nonsense and the headlines from the media. And it's just all kinds of corruption. Cut all of that shit out. And people, when they read studies, they have to watch out for it. Like watch out for those goofy headlines that say like, coffee is good. Or just don't even click on that garbage. It's always epidemiology.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's really important that we really highlight this and focus on it for a couple more minutes. You know, I'm an engineer, right? Like I studied organic chemistry. I'm a material science engineer. I studied organic chemistry, polymer science, upper division statistics, design of experiments, statistical analysis, all these sorts of things.
Biostats. Biostats is crazy.
Yeah. And then worked in aerospace and managed a material testing lab for many years. And so obviously, like that doesn't bring any credence to like my thoughts on nutrition, but I do understand fundamentally, or rather I should say that like once I started to pay attention to how nutrition research is done, I immediately realized the limitations. And I think most people haven't thought this through. Like, for instance, if you want to, you know, if you're an engineer and you want to see like, hey, does this additive make this material stronger? It's really easy to design that experiment to focus on that one factor that you're manipulating and see what the outcome is. Whereas if you want to see if seed oils are good for you or bad for you and compare that to saturated fat, and you want to do that in actual humans and track what happens to them over, you know, decades with their health, it's essentially impossible to do that study. Like it's unethical. You have to like lock people into a metabolic ward and like measure every single other thing that they're eating to control all those variables. You have to somehow try to control like their stress and their smoking and their drinking and like all these other things. You just can't do that. And so what we're left with is these questionnaires, these epidemiological studies that you're talking about, these food surveys and animal models in many cases. And then the rest of it's just like extrapolation and kind of like jumping to conclusions. And and that's why there are people who seem really smart who will tout themselves as evidence-based, who will reference research and make it seem as though anybody who's disagreeing with them is a crazy conspiracy theorist, when it's like, no, it's not that cut and dry. The problem is there's always research on both sides of any given issue, right? Like there's a lot of scientific research published on PubMed that makes seed oils look good. There's also a lot that makes them look bad. And you have to look at all of this with just a lot of critical thinking and like, you know, try to take into account the way all of these studies were done, who paid for them, et cetera, et cetera. Like it's not very simple, you know? Mm-hmm. And yeah, ultimately you have to like put together an argument. And I've paid attention to a lot of this stuff. I get sent a lot of stuff. Like after I had Kate Shanahan on, I got sent a bunch of reels from Dr. Jessica Knurek and from Dr. Mike, that like exercise scientist guy on YouTube famous by criticizing everybody. And they're like, look, he's like steel manning and he says that seed oils are good. And I'm like, well, he says he's steel manning, but he's not taking on Kate Shanahan's argument, like not even close. She just has a way stronger argument, like, you know, as far as where I'm sitting. So I think people just don't know how limited nutrition science is just by design, or by like, I don't know, practicality. Like we just can't do a lot of the types of studies that we would like to do in other fields, you know?
And it's corrupted by the ability to manipulate numbers with biostats. You know, like we used to hire biostaticians And they could pretty much make whatever they wanted to out of the data. Like they could say like red meat is good or red meat is bad based on how they crunch the numbers. And it's pretty shocking. And again, most people don't realize that you can crunch numbers different ways and use different mathematical models or like use different variables to say like, oh, red meat is good and red meat is bad from the exact same data set, right? In these population studies. So a lot of it's just confirmation biasing. A lot of these people are just like, well, we think red meat is bad already. So let's just throw another paper out there that further shows. Like Michael Greger is a good example. Like I've read his book called Dr. Michael Greger. It's called How Not to Die. And I recommend it for people. Like if you want to see it, like the epitome of epidemiology, like he just constantly uses these population-based studies that are garbage. And the whole book, like every page is just full of these studies. But it's interesting to see. And it's interesting to kind of like, I don't know, just how he uses that to show you how good the vegan diet is. And again, I definitely don't espouse the vegan diet. Our ancestors didn't do it for thousands of years. It doesn't really fit anybody's genetics perfectly. Some people can make it work, but you definitely don't want to try and force that onto the population. And Michael Greger wants to, right? Like a lot of these people, they want to, and they're using entirely epidemiology to do that for the most part. I mean, sure, there's maybe 1% of their studies are not epidemiology, you know what I mean? But it's a mess, right? It's really hard to weed through all that stuff unless you're a professional. So mm-hmm. A lot of the times the lie detector test is basically like, what were your ancestors doing for thousands of years? Were your ancestors, that's why I like this fact that you even said you've been following paleo. Were your ancestors eating preservative rich Doritos, like hyper processed, whatever, for thousands of years? If the answer is no, I'd start from a place of extreme skepticism there. And then move forward. Like, and of course, sometimes the studies aren't even done. It's like I said, with the preservatives, a lot of times it's like, you can't even prove they're bad because they haven't done the darn studies, but let's just assume they're bad. Unless we see the studies showing that they're good. And again, they try not to do those studies because they know, like if they do enough studies, they're going to find all kinds of problems. Like with red food coloring, you know, in 2007, you've probably seen my book that I published. It's called Estro Generation.
I haven't read it,
2007, I published that book in 2007. And I was complaining about red 40, red food coloring, because a bunch of European places had made it illegal and Japan had it illegal. And you can read my book. I haven't edited it at all since 2007. And we're finally coming around to saying like, oh, this stuff is garbage. But in my book, I showed a survey that they did with professional scientists on the panel that approved red 40 with the FDA, and 93% of them said, we need more studies. In other words, they approved it, but everybody's saying like, where are the studies? I can't prove you that's bad, but I can't prove it's good either because there's no studies, right? And so I'm saying, let's just start off with the assumption that red 40 is garbage because it messes with your hormones and it causes ADHD. But they didn't do that. They just approved it. And they do this all the time, right? So it's a pattern. If it was just that one thing, it'd be easy to address. But because it's thousands of different things, it's complicated. So always start from the principle of your ancestors ate red meat. Your ancestors ate seafood. Your ancestors ate veggies. That's a pretty good start. Let's start there with our diet.
Seasonal,
you know, like
fruits.
Maybe some nuts and seeds, depending on the person.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a good rule of thumb so people don't get overwhelmed because it can seem to get complicated.
I love that. That's exactly how I think about things. Like with this seed oil conversation, mm-hmm. The starting point is, you know, if you're pro seed oils and you're asserting that they're healthy, then you are saying, and you're saying that they're healthy because they lower cholesterol, cholesterol's bad, red meat's bad because it raises cholesterol. Like that's the argument. What you are saying is red meat, which humans have been eating for roughly 3 million years, is bad for us. And these seed oils, which did not exist 150 years ago. Like I'm talking about these oils that have to be heavily processed to be edible. You know, they have to be refined, bleached, deodorized, then they add coloring back in to make them that nice gold color. They would just be gray if they didn't add dye back into them. Like you're saying that those are healthy. That immediately, like that's our starting point. That's totally ridiculous. The starting point is like, that seems so unlikely. I'm open to being wrong. Like it's possible that through chemistry and science, we've made this even better food, but it just seems so unlikely. And then when you start to really scrutinize the supporting evidence, it's like, you guys just don't have a case at all. It's just this massive house of cards. I know we're coming up on time here. How are you feeling on time? Do you have a little bit more time or
Yeah, we can do 10 minutes. Yeah, let's 10 do more minutes. Like 10 more minutes or less. Yeah.
Okay, that sounds good. So getting back to cholesterol, because this is your area of study, a few questions here to wrap up. How concerned should we be about cholesterol increasing our risk of heart disease? And then on the flip side, what are the implications of lowering cholesterol, either with food or with drugs?
Yeah, that's. I think people should use the 300 as a cutoff, just as a general rule. If you're starting to get your total cholesterol over 300, I do start to get a little bit worried. You better pay attention to the nuance. You better have a really good idea of what you're doing.
So it's not just higher is better. I think that's a good...
Definitely not. Yeah.
Okay, that's
and
good
if it gets, honestly, if it gets below 180, I consider that too low, to be honest too. And I know that's going to like completely shock doctors, but that's what the research shows. If you're starting to get your total cholesterol, and again, it's not, I hate to call it cholesterol, but that's just what the lab test calls it. It's a complete misnomer. But if your total cholesterol is below 180, your cholesterol is too low for your hormones and for your energy most of the time.
Well, there are also studies that associate low cholesterol with higher risk of cancer, which most people don't know either. So,
and strokes and heart attacks, yeah. High risk of heart attacks with super low cholesterol, and certainly brain disorders like dementia. So there's a lot, but again, like there's a sweet spot and it's in the middle. So I think that's a good framework for people.
Is there an LDL sweet spot?
Yeah, but it's more complicated because it depends how much fat you're eating and it depends on, you know, your diet in a lot of different ways. But, I mean, certainly if it's starting to get over 200, I start to worry a little bit. Like, it's like, okay, what are we doing here? But again, even that's a little bit nuanced, you know?
Okay.
So I try not to make generalized recommendations because people will latch onto those and be like, my LDL is 180, so it's totally fine. And it's like, well, maybe it's not. And I'm smoking cigarettes, you know, and it's like, well, there you go. But yeah, it's hard, right? It's really tricky to make generalized blood test recommendations. But I will say I almost never trust the normal range on thyroid blood testing, testosterone blood testing, vitamin D blood testing, glucose, which is blood sugar, and all the cholesterol metrics. Like most of those normal ranges are not optimal at all. And I think people should at least recognize that that is a fact, you know, and the research shows that. Like you can look at these triglyceride studies on where the optimal range is, and it's very clearly below 85 for your triglycerides. I think you can say that very generally is true. And then you go to the doctor and you get a 140 and they're like, oh, you're fine. Like, I don't care, you know, because there's no drugs to give you for the most part for your triglycerides. So a lot of it is corrupted and it's just based on averages in America, and average Americans aren't very healthy. So it's worth paying attention to, and it's worth researching and looking for what is the optimal range. And I talk a lot about that on YouTube videos for different blood tests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've shared this many times on the show, but Charles Poliquin, the strength coach, used to always say, when you think of normal, you should think of Homer Simpson.
Yeah,
when it comes to awesome. Blood work and reference ranges and stuff. And that's just stuck in my head ever since. I think that's such a good visual for folks.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do we wrap up? Is there any other, like what feels incomplete? Is there anything else you want to make sure we hit on before I let you go?
I mean, obviously there's like a million things we could talk about.
If you don't have anything burning, I have one more idea that I think we should hit on.
Sure, go ahead. Yeah, nothing's burning over here.
So I'm sure that people, you know, it's so easy to get overwhelmed with this stuff. What are the practical, tangible takeaways for folks? I mean, I know I'm not asking you to give dietary advice for folks because it, like you've said, it depends on their genetics and so many other factors, but big bang wins, you know, is it just like mostly sticking to ancestrally aligned whole ingredient food, like single ingredient whole foods, or what are your thoughts on what people should actually go do?
I like that. I mean, I was on board with that for sure. Most people should be fasting to some extent also. That is pretty consistent in most people's genetics. There's a few rare exceptions, but more likely than not, your genes are going to line up with some intermittent fasting or even like 24-hour fasting occasionally and stuff like that. Like throw some fasting in there. It's really good for autophagy. It's really good for clearing garbage out of your cells and getting rid of trash in your cells. Your ancestors were doing it. So once again, that goes back to the ancestral principles. I don't want to sound like Liver King because he's full of nonsense and steroids. But I mean, the idea
nonsense
of ancestral
and steroids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's on the right track a little bit. at least with the philosophy of like, let's think about what our ancestors were doing.
Well, that's what makes all this so tricky, right? Like there's always a crazy person who's gone way too far the other way that makes everybody who's trying to be reasonable look bad.
yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I think that's a good way for people to individually think. And then, of course, don't take the steroids like he was doing, the $11,000 a month worth of steroids. But and who knows what else kind of weird stuff recently. Yeah, let's see. Fasting, sunshine. I mean, sunshine, absolutely everybody should get a little bit of sunshine. You know, don't go out and get fried and get sunburned. But oh my gosh, you got to start getting out in the sun. This demonization of sunshine is completely insane. The tide is starting to turn.
Yeah.
But people need to be aware that the tide is turning because they haven't been told. They haven't been updated. Like eggs are good and sunshine is good. Like let's get the word out. But again, that's ancestral and it's commonsensical, but people have just been beaten down to the ground on this idea that like sunshine is bad. Let me think. I mean, there's so many little things. Exercise, you know, like I obviously you got to exercise, you got to be moving, you got to be active to some degree, no matter what your genetics are, you know, your ancestors are moving, right?
Yeah. That's another thing I don't talk about enough. Like, I think Peter Attia has said that, and I know you disagree with him. I disagree with him too on many things, but one thing I like that he says is that like, if exercise could be bottled and put in like a pill form, it would be like a multi-billion dollar successful, like most successful drug of all time. Exercise is a superpower for sure.
Yeah, sweating is really good too. So yeah, those are some of the things. And I love the whole foods notion, right? Like eat healthy whole foods. And it's kind of almost obvious and people kind of know that, but they struggle because of the time constraints and it's complicated to make food. So they just go and get a pizza and they heat it up in the oven and it's like, oh, now you're back to processed garbage. The other thing that's I'll add in closing is, excuse me, a lot of people don't recognize how bad it is to eat sugar and fats together. Like hyperprocessed sugar with hyperprocessed fats is like the worst thing you can do. Like if you want to give, like this is in the context of this whole sugar diet thing, right? Because there's people that are successfully eating nothing but sugar and they're losing weight. And again, you would lose weight with cocaine too. So I'm not promoting this, but I'm just saying like, if you get rid of fats and you just eat a ton of sugar, some people do okay with that. I don't think it's good for people. And some people do okay with just tons of fats and zero sugar. And again, I'm not even okay with that. I don't think that's ideal for the long term. It helps reset your metabolism. So that's a good diet sometimes in really specific cases temporarily. But people need to understand if you're eating a whole, it's called the Randle cycle, R-A-N-D-L-E. If you're eating a whole bunch of carbs, like sugar especially, and fats at the same time, your body's just pumping that right into your fat stores, you know? And so that's the worst of both worlds. And that's what we do. Like if you want to give animals diabetes in research studies, and we used to do this, I used to do this all the time. You don't just give them sugar. You give them sugar with a bunch of hyperprocessed fats, like seed oils, and that numbs their insulin response super fast. So like these desserts, like cheesecake or whatever, with a bunch of sugar and a bunch of fat in it, that's bad, like no question. So watch out for those. Those are the worst offenders when you have that combination.
What about in the context of real food, like eating sweet potatoes with red meat, for instance, or fruit with meat and things like that? Like, I can't imagine that that's the worst
exactly
thing, right?
It's not the same. It doesn't hit your system the same.
Okay.
It's kind of like fluoride, and I've done videos explaining this with fluoride, where if you drink it in the water, it blasts into your system. It's a lot more neurotoxic. And I know that's a totally different topic, but I mean, it is.
Frankly. I did an episode on this. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah. They did 55 studies, the government, the HHS, which RFK is in charge of now, 55 studies, 50 on fluoride, 53 of them showed neurotoxicity at any dose, and they suppressed the studies. They hid it. They're being sued right now for hiding the data. So anybody who says like, there's no data on fluoride, it's like, well, yeah, because the government was hiding it. But also, bananas have fluoride. Shrimp has fluoride. Like seafood has fluoride. If you eat it from Whole Foods, it's totally fine because it slowly absorbs into your system. No big deal, right? But if you blast it in your system with a bunch of drinking water, which is totally unnatural, yeah, you're going to have neurotoxicity, right? So that's how you should think about it, is blasting your system with sugar and fats. It's bad.
My favorite comment after my fluoride episode was from some climber, and he just said, like, I was getting a bunch of backlash. People were, you know, calling me a conspiracy theorist or something for suggesting that maybe drinking fluoride doesn't make sense. And he's just like, I don't understand what you guys are all freaking out about. Your internal organs don't have teeth. I was just like, that's perfect. I know, that's
if
exactly
you
want
to brush your teeth with fluoride, right?
Yeah,
it should be a choice.
Spit it out. Just don't swallow it. What the fuck?
Exactly. Yeah. Shouldn't be controversial.
Oh man, I could talk to you for hours. I wish we had more time. I'm so sorry. I have to ask this one last question. I think we talked about this a little bit, but just in summary, if people aren't getting cholesterol, if they're keeping their cholesterol super low, they are missing out on what? Fill in the blank.
For men, testosterone. For women, progesterone and estrogen. And just general energy. I mean, it's important for your brain performance, brain function, your cell walls. Like every single cell in your whole body is surrounded by a cell wall. It's like a pillowcase. Those pillowcases are full of cholesterol. It helps to keep the fluidity proper. So you're missing, you know, it's just basic biochemistry. Like your whole biology needs cholesterol. And if you get it super low, you're just not going to feel as good too. You'll notice the feeling. That's the craziest irony here is I've talked to thousands of people, literally thousands since 2010, I've been doing genetic consulting. And just over and over and over, I get emails. People feel better. They lose a whole bunch of weight. And then the doctor tells them they're doing something wrong, like because their cholesterol increased a little bit. And that's ridiculous, right? So just how you feel is a great metric for health. You can trust that a lot more than you can trust most of the blood tests on the market. So That's a valid metric. How do you feel? You feel better when your cholesterol's higher within reason. Obviously, you get it too high and you don't feel better. So there's a reasonable Goldilocks zone.
Yeah. I love that. Amazing. I will link to all the things Dr. Anthony J in the show notes and right there in the episode description for this episode for you guys. I'll link to his YouTube channel, his Instagram, the Blue Zones video, and some of the other ones that we talked about. And your genetic testing, do you have a website for that? Can people book online consulting with you or things like that?
Yeah.
I'm actually very intrigued. I might hit you up and do that. I've never tested my genetics before, and I'm pretty intrigued about that.
Yeah, I tell people to use an alias, like register with the company with a fake name, you know, be really super confidential. But it's ajconsultingcompany.com.
Okay.
Right. So all those people that have done the 23andMe test or the Ancestry test, like when you do Ancestry.com's DNA test, they test 700,000 SNPs. And then they just tell you like what part of the country you're from or what part of the world you're from. It's like there's such a wealth of information in that data set that they don't tap into. It's just like a travesty, you know?
Wow. So I see. So people who have already done these kind of mainstream genetic testing things can just send you their data and you
that's
can,
how I work. Yeah.
Gotcha.
That's how I
gotcha.
Buy
that's
my
cool.
own software that analyzes. Yep.
Do you have a preference about like the initial source of the data? Like which?
Not too much. No. Like 23andMe is awesome. Almost all those companies, ironically, people should just price shop. Because all those companies use the same third-party testing company.
That's how the whole world works. That's everything. amazing. Okay, I'll link to your website as well. Is there anything else that people should know about?
No, man. Appreciate you, Steven. Keep up the good work, man.
All right, appreciate you too, man. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Okay,
bye.
All right, my friends, what did you think of that? Did this conversation change any of the beliefs you hold about cholesterol or eating meat or saturated fat? Did it challenge any of your beliefs about science or corruption in science? If it did, I would love to hear about it. And I would love it even more if you shared this conversation with a friend and used it to strike up a conversation. Share this episode, talk about it, and I'd love to hear what you took away. Before I let you go, a quick reminder to head over to MauiNuiVenison.com/Steven if you want to try some of the most nutritious and most ethical meat on the planet. I recently interviewed Jake Muse, the CEO and founder of Maui Nui Venison, and loved my conversation with him. So be sure to check that out if you missed it. And gentlemen, be sure to check out NADS if you need to restock your underwear drawer. These are 100% organic cotton underwear. I like their boxer briefs in black, but they have several styles and colors. These are the most comfortable underwear I've ever owned, and you can get 15% off when you use code STEVEN at checkout. And finally, if you want to support the podcast directly, I have a brand new Patreon that you can find at patreon.com/somethingdiffpod. I rely on listener support to make these podcasts happen. So if you have the means, you can head over there and I would love your support. Links to everything in the episode description below, including links to Dr. Anthony J. if you want to book a DNA consultation with him. Thank you so much for listening. Much love to all of you. And we will see you next time. Boom.